Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. The path of practice which the Buddha taught is called the Eightfold Path. One cannot say enough times that even though that during one talk one might emphasize one particular factor or a small subgroup of factors of the Eightfold Path, the Eightfold Path should nevertheless be always regarded as a whole, as something indivisible, where all the factors support one another, and if any one of those factors is absent, then it really hinders the development of the others. And as far as the path towards enlightenment is concerned, as far as that which gives rise to what we call Magapala, the insights which eradicate the fetters, that the whole path has to be developed. And so even though that sometimes that one emphasizes one aspect, please never think that that emphasis means that's all one should be doing. Quite often that one just emphasizes part of the Eightfold Path which one thinks might be weak or which might be hard to develop or hard to understand, and so one has the obligation, the duty to investigate and to talk about and to explain those parts of the Eightfold Path which might be a bit misty. However, this evening, just picking the subject out of the hat as I move from my seat over there up to the Dharma seat, I think it's been quite a while since I gave a talk on the seventh factor of the Eightfold Path, just sati. One of the reasons why I don't usually give a talk on mindfulness is because and many other monks give talks on mindfulness to the point where as a monk, when I was listening to talks, it seemed that every monk would always be giving a talk on mindfulness, and so that I wanted to give a talk on something else. But because I've been giving a talk on something else, now's the time to talk maybe on mindfulness. It is the factor of the Eightfold Path. It is one of the balas, one of the powers. It is one of the bojangas. It's an important part of this path towards enlightenment, and it's also a result of practice. But it is something which can be misunderstood. Misunderstood because there are different levels of this thing we call sati or mindfulness. And I'd like to begin by just one of the basic practices for arousing mindfulness, and it's called anapana sati. Sometimes when people give talks on sati, they just confine themselves to the four foundations of mindfulness, the satipatthana. That's very important, but I've given talks on that before, and many other monks give talks on the satipatthana. So I'm trying to just work around the satipatthana to some other aspects of mindfulness. And first of all, to notice that anapana sati is one of the ways of developing mindfulness. It's actually part of the satipatthana. But I like to just to investigate and talk about the development of mindfulness through anapana sati. When one is developing mindfulness, one can develop it by using this technique of just watching the breath. And by trying to watch the breath, one sees how difficult it is to to develop sati, to develop like mindfulness and awareness of what's going on. When one starts to watch the breath, the mind tends to go away. Or the mind tends to be foggy and muggy, and one cannot really see the breath very clearly. Or that the mind is just partially aware, aware of a little bit of the breath and a lot of thinking. And one can see straight away that this thing we call sati and mindfulness is something which does not come easily, even to monks who have been practicing for many years, let alone to people who just began monastic life, let alone to people who even haven't started the intense and full-on training of monastic life. And very often this thing which we call sati and mindfulness is not really appreciated. That which is just small mindfulness, partial mindfulness, a very weak mindfulness, is considered to be the almost like the acme and pinnacle, and that all one really needs to become enlightened. You can see that when one is developing mindfulness of the breath in the anapanasati, you see that the problem is twofold. First of all, that sati needs to be maintained, and really to call it mindfulness when it's flitting from one thing to another thing to another thing to another thing, it's not really what the Buddha was talking about as mindfulness. It's a mindfulness which hasn't really much value. The mindfulness of the breath is only perfected, it's only like achieved when that mindfulness stays with the breath, is continually applied to the breath. And then the mindfulness on the breath, as it were, is established. And you may also notice that anapanasati is part of kayagata sati, the mindfulness of the body. And even if it's mindfulness of the body, it has to be established and maintained on the body. In the same way as it has to be established and maintained on the breath. And if you cannot maintain the awareness on the breath, you will not be able to maintain the awareness on the body, nor will you be able to maintain the awareness on the feelings, on the mind objects, or the other satipatthana. And so I'm using now the ability to be mindful of the breath as a good standard, as a good indicator of the level of one's mindfulness, the level of one's awareness, whether it's sufficient to do the job required by the Eightfold Path. And so sometimes if we do just ordinary mindfulness, what some people call ordinary mindfulness, just be aware, just know what's going on, you can see that that sort of mindfulness is not sufficient. The sort of mindfulness required is that degree of mindfulness which, if you apply to the breath, you can maintain the attention there continuously. So that's one of the first things about the sort of mindfulness which is required by the Buddha for realizing the Dhamma. The continuity, which is like a feature of this mindfulness required. And the other thing, of course, is its like quality, its sharpness, its ability to pick up all the information of what's going on in there. So it's not just the ability to maintain attention required by sati, but also the quality of that attention. And you may know just from ordinary experience that sometimes the faculties are dull, and that one only picks up a minor portion of what's going on, and much of what's happening one misses. It's as if one is asleep or half asleep, and you know the mindfulness in sleep states or sleepy states, or sometimes the mindfulness when you get up from a very deep, or like not so much a deep sleep but like an uncomfortable sleep, a disturbed sleep for one reason or another, when I'm still tired, the mindfulness isn't sharp, one still sort of knows but doesn't know well enough. That dull state of mindfulness which is the mindfulness obstructed by the fourth hindrance of sloth and torpor, can be compared just to the ordinary mindfulness which you may be experiencing now. So you can see there's different qualities of that thing which we call mindfulness. Okay, I mean, you can still be aware to the extent that, you know, I'm sleepy, but there's so many things going on in the mind you cannot catch. The mind is foggy, the mind is dark. And as one cultivates mindfulness, one should be cultivating the sharpness and clarity of that mindfulness, as well as its continual application on one particular object. With the a mindfulness on the breath, again using this as like a benchmark of what mindfulness means, that when the mindfulness is not just continually on the breath, but is clearly on the breath as well, that's when the mindfulness is established to the point you can start to do things like enter jhanas and gain great insights. When it's sharp enough to see the breath so clearly, so precisely, that actually the breath becomes enjoyable, it becomes pleasant. Very often, the reason why that, what I keep on calling in my previous talk, the beautiful breath, or the samadhi nimitta, the piti sukha, which will take you into jhana, one of the reasons why that doesn't arise is because the mindfulness isn't sharp enough, isn't clear enough. The faculties are still too dull. There's a very minor amount of sloth and torpor there, a lack of energy, a lack of balance in the mind, which can obstruct the mind seeing clearly exactly what is going on. Exactly, clearly, like turning up lights in a room. So, like spotlighting, so that it's all the floors, all the scratches in the wooden floor up above can be seen when you put spotlights on. But when you don't have spotlights, you can't see anything. It looks okay. So the mindfulness is being sharp enough, floodlit enough, to be able to see what's really going on. So this is the sort of mindfulness which the Buddha was asking his monks to generate. And it's why that something like Anapanasati is a very powerful tool to generate mindfulness and also to know what mindfulness means and the degree required for the task of uncovering the truth, discovering the Dhamma and gaining some of the fruits of this practice. One can understand when one does these practices of like developing Anapanasati, one can understand then the different grades of mindfulness, and one can understand how just ordinary mindfulness, the sort of mindfulness one has during most of the day, isn't really sufficient. And one will not be able to either understand the world or understand one's mind. And very often one will just take that which is delusion to be truth. That which one sees or think one sees or think one perceives, but what is actually misperception, misthought, misview, one will take that to be truth and the way things are. What's happening here is the mindfulness isn't sharp enough. The mindfulness hasn't been developed. There's still a foggy mind. And one misses the truth. One misses seeing what the Buddha saw. And one understands this because in one's daily life, in the monastery, developing samatha meditation, as well as vipassana, developing these powerful mind states, I hope by now that you will have appreciated that as the mind quietens down, especially as it goes towards these things which we call jhanas or even enters jhanas, the mindfulness increases, both its quality and its ability to be maintained on the object which you choose. You experience, even if you don't get into a jhana, if you just, the closer you get, you experience fuller, more powerful, more effective degrees of mindfulness. This is what you experience and feel and see. The mind has more power to maintain its attention on something, and that attention is sharper, more brilliant. Like sometimes you start to see in the suttas that very often they use the metaphor of light in the mind as the way of overcoming sloth and torpor, being developing the aloka sanya, the development of like light. You start to see that the mind which enters a jhana, you know, is called pabhasara, the realm of those beings who have developed the second jhana and get reborn in the plane which is dependent upon that achievement and which has the qualities of that experience, the second jhana. Those are the abhasara devas. These are like the radiant beings. And this radiance, this light, is like the metaphor of a mind which has developed enough mindfulness and clarity that one perceives this as shining, as radiant. Again, I will make the statement at this point, that which we call the chakhu vijnana, the eye, sense, and the sense of sight, has stopped. This is mind things, mind states. So one cannot really call it radiance in the sense of seeing light. This is very often how it appears, because the mind is strong and bright in the metaphorical state, sense, metaphorical sense. And to many meditators, the perception, the appearance of the mind, the nearest thing to compare to that state would be brilliance. So this idea of brilliance in the mind in these states, whether it's just prior to a jhana or in a jhana, is a sign of the mindfulness increasing, as if the jitta is so bright that whatever it shines on, it sees things just so minutely, so precisely, illuminated as it were through the power of the mind. And everyone should have experienced at least some things close enough to jhanas to know that when the mind is close, the mind is sharp, and it does have this feeling of being bright. So whatever you look at, you can see very clearly, whether it's the breath, whether it's the remaining hindrances, whether it's sometimes the feelings in the body, whatever it is you turn to, you can see it so much more sharply. And so one can appreciate the mindfulness at this state. This state is so much more useful and powerful. You know that compared to ordinary mindfulness, I'm not talking about the low mindfulness of sleepy states, the ordinary mindfulness of the ordinary people in the world, but this mindfulness just prior to a jhana is so much more powerful. And then you can understand for yourselves why the ordinary mindfulness cannot be enough to uncover these very profound teachings of the Dhamma, these things which not many people can see. The Buddha used to say that most people are as if having eyes covered with dust, and some have much dust, some have little dust. Again, those dust over the eyes can be like compared to that which hinders full mindfulness, and of course that dust will be the hindrances themselves, the five hindrances. It is the five hindrances which stop mindfulness, which obstruct it. They are called upakilesas of the mind. These upakilesas, these like refined stains, impurities, defilements of the mind. And the mind, when it's removed of those defilements, that's when it's called pabhasara. according to that Anguttara quote. And then it shines on its object, and it has mindfulness. Again, not in its fullness, but pretty close to it. And in sufficient degree to gain the insights. So please know the different degrees of mindfulness, and that which is useful and that which is not. For the main task of the monastic, which is uncovering the Dhamma. And even if one goes deeper into the jhanas, one sees that even though the quality of that mindfulness just prior to jhana is sharp enough, it's powerful enough, it's bright enough, its weakness is that it cannot be maintained. It's still unstable. And it's only through developing the rupa jhanas until they say in the fourth jhana is the pinnacle of mindfulness. And they say it's like the parisuddhi, the purity of mindfulness and equanimity. That's the character of the fourth jhana. So that's where mindfulness comes to its peak, according to what the Buddha said. And what I'm saying here is a difference between the mindfulness of the upachara, of just prior to jhanas, and in this fourth jhana, is its ability to be maintained, its imperturbability. So these two qualities of mindfulness I'm pointing out now, its strength, its power, and its ability to be maintained. And sometimes we don't appreciate that, which is why many people don't practice mindfulness and gain results from it. However, as we practice mindfulness, we can throughout the day take our objects, whatever we are doing, whether it's doing walking meditation, whether it's doing meditation on the breath, or any other meditations which we are doing, and we can apply mindfulness, and especially remembering these two aspects of it. And what you are doing here is not being mindful in order to understand the Dhamma, to understand the Dhamma in the sense of gaining Magunpala. Here you are building up the mindfulness. This is not the time when you can expect great insights. This is the time when you're building up and cultivating the faculty of mindfulness, bringing it to fulfillment, bringing it to strength. And it is the practice in the forest tradition to develop mindfulness so it can be strong enough for the task of gaining the deep insights. And the developing of mindfulness is that which can be done at any stage in one's daily routine. And we're doing this in order to strengthen it so that when we can sit down, meditate, we're walking meditation in the formal part of the meditation, that's when all that we built up in the daytime can bear its fruit. And so whether we're eating, whether we're talking, whether we're coming and going, that's where we can apply and strengthen our mindfulness. And how do we do that? We recollect where we are, we remember where we are, we keep our attention in the present moment. So we know, and we strengthen that awareness. It's not enough just to know. We have to know clearly. We have to know fully. We have to know as if this mindfulness develops so it's so sharp that whatever we're doing, we are fully aware of it, not just aware, fully aware. And so that full awareness is something which we develop by an act of will, by arousing energy, by developing the five powers of faith, energy, mindfulness itself, and samadhi and panya. And this becomes our task in the ordinary, so-called ordinary moments of life, of monastic life. we're developing this tool and strengthening it. Even if one is doing some work, if one is cooking or sweeping or whatever one is doing, it always gives you an opportunity to develop this sort of mindfulness. And there was a story in the Living Buddhist Masters of the Burmese monk, I forget his name, who was unable to ordain because of his commitments to his wife and family, but who certainly had tremendous faith in the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, and so decided that he'd work especially hard to save money in order to set up his wife and children so he could then leave them and become a monk. And in the meantime, as he was working, ploughing the fields, that he would develop the mindfulness of the touch against the plough, as well as other mindfulness on the body, the kayagata sati. But this just wasn't ordinary mindfulness on the body. This fellow at the time was developing it again to be very, very sharp and very well maintained. So it was a he developed his ability to continually apply this mindfulness and to make it very, very full and very sharp and brilliant. And this became his practice as a lay person. And so he was at this time developing the powers, developing the strengths, so that when he had saved up the money and given it to his family and left his family and become a monk, he had the strength of mindfulness, the ability to be able to take hold of whatever object was appropriate at the time and to illuminate it with the power of mindfulness which he developed and cultivated, and to maintain that illumination on the object, whether it was on the breath to gain jhanas or on the five khandhas to gain insight, or the ayatanas, the sense basis, to gain insight. He had the sati, he had the strength. So in our daily life we are doing the development of mindfulness in order to give it strength to be used for gaining insight. But the development of mindfulness in our daily life has another purpose as well, because it does guard us from developing bad states of mind, bad ways of speech and bad actions. Because when we're aware of these things, we tend also to be aware of their dangers, to be aware of their results. We become more aware of what we're doing, we become more aware of the consequences. And this too becomes an important part of mindfulness, that which guards us. The unmindful person, in this sense, is a person who is heedless. They don't even see what they're doing, let alone try and overcome sort of bad states of mind or bad activities and actions to restrain them, to put forth effort. If you don't know what you're doing, there's no even opportunity for effort to arise and bear its fruit. And so that the development of mindfulness in this particular state, or and daily life and ordinary things, also has the power of protecting us. Now this is the development of mindfulness in daily life, and it's developed to become a great strength and a power, and especially one can test the power of one's mindfulness in these two aspects of being able to maintain the attention on a thing and to be able to make it brilliant by doing things like anapanasati and knowing if it's strong enough by the state of samatha which you achieve. However, there is another part of mindfulness which also needs to be mentioned, which again is very rarely talked about in the talks which one hears or the books which are written. Now and again it comes up, and that is that part of mindfulness which is like remembering which like recollects, and especially which recollects the Dhamma, which recollects the teachings which one has heard in the time of the Buddha. He was sort of saying, I think it was in a sutta read out the other night, that in the early days that he didn't really need to, this is a sutra I read out a couple of weeks ago, in the early days he didn't need to lay down many rules. All he needed to do was to bring up sati to the monks. And there was a story of the two monks who, after living the life of monks, were reborn, I think it was in the Tower Tings of Heaven, and the lay supporter, the lady who was looking after them for all these years, was born in the Tusita realm, which was much higher. And when she saw that these two monks she'd been looking after and slaving over and cooking for hadn't obviously been doing the job, she was a bit upset, and she went back. She went down to that Tower Tings of Heaven and she remonstrated with them. She told them that what they were doing was not really good enough. That if you're looking after a monk and you're supporting him, or if it's a nun or whoever, you're expecting them to do something. And if they don't do that, you have almost like a understandable a right to remonstrate upon them. They are taking your alms food and not using it properly. And what she did was to remonstrate with them, and they say that one of those monks aroused sati, and as a result of arousing sati in that realm they were gained magapala, gained insight, path and fruit, and were reborn in the realm of the non-returners. And I've always contemplated both those two quotes. And to me, anyway, I haven't checked in the commentaries, but to me that those sati which they were developing then, or sati which was aroused then, was the recollecting, remembering the teachings of the Buddha, which they had been taught before, which they'd forgotten. They'd forgotten the danger of sensuality in this realm, these two monks. The monks who were maybe about to misbehave in the early days of the Buddha had forgotten the dangers, what the Buddha had talked about, all the similes he had given about sensual pleasures and their danger, and all they needed was just to be reminded of these things. And all those two monks, or one of those two monks in the Tower Tings of Heaven, need to be reminded of the Dhamma. And then reminding of the Dhamma to see the Dhamma and to penetrate the Dhamma and thereby gain Magapala and become an Anagami. It seems to be in the heavenly realms the faculties are so refined that the hindrances aren't that strong if one can develop the memory of the Dhamma. I don't know, that's just a possibility, a speculation of mine. But anyhow, the aspect of mindfulness which especially remembers the Dhamma is also very important. The Dhamma which we have heard, which we have listened to, is often forgotten. And unfortunately it's often forgotten when it's most needed. Many of you who I've talked to in the interview times, when it comes very close to entering a jhana, sometimes that sati which remembers the Dhamma can be so important to take you just that one step further and attain a jhana and get in there. The little pieces of Dhamma like anicca, dukkha, anatta, the fact that this is not you doing this thing, let go, leave the mind alone, the mind will do this by itself. Now the anicca, that these things, they're impermanent, they will end by themselves. Sometimes people have fears, and it's amazing just how often people have this fear, is, well, if I get in this, I won't be able to come out again. Because you're giving up control. One of the aspects of the entry into one of the jhana states is that the sense of self or its function to control and order is being abandoned and given up. You're actually doing some abandoning. You're actually doing some letting go. Jhana is born of letting go. It is not born of attaching. And what you're letting go of, especially as one goes into these states, is that function of delusion called the ego, which controls and manipulates and says, do this and do that. The origin of fear. And just having that sati, which remembers some of these teachings, which remembers something like anatta and its meaning, that this isn't you, this isn't yours, so stop worrying about it. Stop having fear or exhilaration. And just that sati, that degree of sati, that memory of the teachings of the Dhamma will be enough to just take you all the way into a nice jhana. So often, the difference between gaining samadhi and not gaining samadhi is not more effort of will, but just this wisdom, this panya. It's the panya which gives rise to samadhi, the wisdom which gives rise to peaceful states. That wisdom, where does it come from? You've heard it before. It's just using it at the right time. And this using at the right time is this function of mindfulness which remembers, which recalls. And once this aspect of sati is developed, not only is it useful for the entry into a jhana, but it's also useful at the exit of a jhana. When one emerges from a jhana, the first few times you emerge from a jhana, what the mind looks at is just the beauty of what has happened, the wonder, the marvel. And sometimes that can delay or obstruct the main purpose of all of this, which is to gain the deep insights of Magapala, the stages of enlightenment. Because one is concerned with like a marvelous, intriguing, exciting event which had just happened. What was this? And the mind just dwells on the experience, on the pleasure of the experience, on the wonder of the experience. It's okay if you attain jhana many, many times, because like assessing all of this, what actually happened, what it was and what the factors were and how it happened and why it came out and being taken up by the fabulous experience which just happened. If you get into jhanas many, many times, you know, you've dealt with that one. And it becomes an experience which you know very well. You don't spend so much time after a jhana reflecting on the jhana itself. You instead arouse that mindfulness which remembers the Dhamma. You remember anicca, dukkha, anatta. And it's very hard at first to arouse anicca, which is like a negative quality when the mind has just been blissed out. And it is you understand if you read the suttas, it was the great obstacle for the devas in the Brahma realm. Remember, the Brahma realm is that realm which is based on the first jhana. Beings who develop first jhana get reborn in the Brahma realms. And in those Brahma realms, the joy is so great that they forget, they have no sati of the Dhamma, no recollection of the Dhamma. And it was a job, whether of the Buddha or Mahamoggallana, to arouse that sati so that the Brahmas, they too could remember anicca. It wasn't a natural thing to remember in these stages, because it was a negative. This beautiful, wonderful, marvelous, delightful state, of course, it's not natural, it's not attractive at first to think that such a marvelous state could be impermanent, it's going to change, it's going to leave you. But the sati is necessary, which reminds one of the Buddha's teachings. This too is impermanent. Or the sati of dukkha, to actually arouse after a jhana even the very idea that this too can be dukkha. Wow, that's a very difficult thing to do. But without it, one cannot gain the Magga-Nipala. So the development of the mindfulness at the exit to a jhana can also be that which arouses the thought, the idea, having exited from jhana, of dukkha. And it can also arouse the thought of anatta. You've just had a marvelous experience, and usually at the exit to a jhana you feel actually proud of yourself. Wow, at last, I've done it. Rather than thinking of this is just the natural thing which has happened according to causes, it's not me, it's not mine. Of course it goes against the grain to think that the achievement which one has spent many years developing and now finally it's occurred is not yours. Not you. You haven't done it. But it is necessary at this time, if one is going to achieve Magga-Nipala, to have developed that sati which keeps on bringing up anicca, dukkha, anatta, which keeps on recalling it, which throughout the day keep on bringing up, keep remembering, develop that remembering. These are the tools of a Buddhist monk or a Buddhist nun. Anicca, dukkha, anatta. The more you can recall it in daily life, the more likely it will be recalled at the exit from a jhana. And instead of blissing out on the post-jhanic feelings and thinking this is beautiful, this is permanent, or it's not going to disappear for a long time, at least I hope it doesn't, and this is me, this is mine, you just recall anicca, this too is impermanent, this too is dukkha, the Buddha said, even though you don't know why yet, this too is not self. And you have that sati, that mindfulness, that remembering, post-jhana, and then you're knocking on the door of Nibbana. You're right standing next to it, so close to it, that you have the greatest chance in the world with that powerful combination of actually gaining the powerful, wonderful fruits of realization. That sati has to be developed throughout the day. And this again, remember, is the sati, the remembering of mindfulness. So the mindfulness, the remembering, which is recalling the Dhamma which the Buddha taught, anicca, dukkha, anatta. Whatever you're doing during the day, keep on recalling that. Make it a habit. Whether you're giving a talk, whether you're eating the meal, whether you're going to the toilet, whether you're driving in the car, whether you're coming to the hall, whether you're reading a book, until the development of the mindfulness that is anicca, the mindfulness that is dukkha, the mindfulness of anatta, you remember it so well, it's as if it's like with you throughout the day. It keeps coming up. And whatever happens to you, it's still always in the back of the mind, anicca again, dukkha again, anatta again. And if you develop this ability just to keep the Dhamma in mind at all times, to remember the beautiful teachings of the Buddha, of the Arahats, of the Kuba Arjan for 25 centuries, they've been screaming at it, shouting at you, to remember it. To cultivate that memory of it, to cultivate that sati of it. Then one day when you do get into jhana and you come out the other end, it will rise by itself. Anicca will be like a light which shines in the mind. And the mind will be powerful enough to see the depth of anicca, will be powerful enough once dukkha shines in the mind, be powerful enough to penetrate the depth of dukkha, will be powerful enough to penetrate the depth of anatta. As those, that monk in the Tower Tings of Heaven, he just needed to be reminded, and there it was. But sometimes that's what happens when people give talks, or when the Buddha gave a talk especially. When the mind was calm enough, and instead of like sati being arisen from within, just the Buddha talked, that he put anicca in the monk's mind, he put dukkha anatta in the monk's mind. And that powerful combination just gave rise to enlightenment. That's the high, the beautiful, the supreme sati. But even in ordinary life, at all times, some of the Buddha's teachings, if we could only keep remembering them, they'll keep protecting us. So often when we get into dukkha, why is that? We keep forgetting. We know these things when they're pointed out, when someone says these things to us. We know them afterwards when we reflect upon them. Well, I shouldn't have done that. Why did I do that? How many years have I been a monk? That sati which keeps the Dhamma in mind will be that which protects you at all times. If ever you are getting into any sensual lust, if there's only the sati which reminded you that the Buddha said again and again and again and again that this is going to cause you dukkha and others dukkha. If you could only remember that, then sensual lust will have no chance to establish itself in your mind. What happens is that sensual lust comes up and we forget what the Buddha taught. And we think what Mara teaches us at that time. This is beautiful, this is fun, this is going to be enjoyable. Where the anger comes up, ill will, wanting revenge on someone else. We think at that time that this is what's appropriate. We forget the Buddha's teachings. We forget the Buddha's teachings because we haven't cultivated that aspect of mindfulness which remembers and recalls, which keeps the teachings in mind. And even like little teachings, wise teachings, living in the present moment, stop allowing the mind to go wandering backwards and forwards, let go of desires, live simple, have a simple mind, guard the mind, develop hiri-otapa. All of these marvellous teachings of the Buddha, hiri-otapa is like the shame and moral dread. You know, the shame of doing something wrong, even small wrong things, even a thought which is wrong. You develop even shame to that degree. And the dread is the realization, this is going to have consequences, you've done something which is going to hurt you and frustrate your progress towards the bliss of enlightenment. So all of these little things, we can only recall and remember them. They will protect us. They will help and push us forward on the path. So even the mindfulness of remembering the Dhamma in daily life is so powerful and important. So this aspect of mindfulness, which was remembering the teachings of the Buddha, the powerful teachings of the Buddha, at least you've heard the teachings of the Buddha, you know them. Many people in the world do not have the opportunity to hear the teachings of the Buddha. Many people would not even know the meaning of anicca, dukkha, anatta, would find the whole idea just quite inconceivable. But you have the fortunate beings who have heard the Dhamma of the Buddha, that which the Buddha himself taught. Many of you have heard teachings from the Kuba Ajahn, from the Aryas. What you have to do now is develop the mindfulness which remembers those, which recalls them at all times. When you're walking back to your hut, when you begin to sit meditation, recall the Dhamma at the very beginning. Anicca, dukkha, anatta. what the Buddha taught, the danger of sensual pleasures, the karma of akusala karma is even one thought of lust is akusala karma, unwholesome karma, which has its result of dukkha, let alone sort of many thoughts. Remember the Dhamma of the Buddha. Remember the examples of the great teachers at the beginning of one's meditation, in the middle of one's meditation, at the end of one's meditation, when one is walking, when one goes to sleep at night, when one wakes up in the morning, until the Dhamma becomes just part of you. The mindfulness of the Dhamma has come to perfection. Not to perfection yet, sorry, but almost to perfection. It comes to perfection when one penetrates and becomes enlightened. Then the mindfulness which remembers the Dhamma, you cannot forget it, it's there all the time. You live in the Dhamma, you are the Dhamma. Only at the point of being an arahat, there the mindfulness is complete and fulfilled. The Dhamma is that which you see. Dukkha is that which you experience. Anicca is experience. Anatta is always there. So these two aspects of mindfulness, which I've talked about today, are both practiced in daily life and are practiced at the entrance into the jhanas, the exit to the jhanas, and where they come to the most useful aspects. When the hindrances have disappeared and you remember the Dhamma, you're clear, you're mindful, you're fully conscious. The two aspects being the sharpness of the mind, the brilliance of mindfulness, which sees everything which is before the consciousness so sharply, clearly, fully. Then that aspect of mindfulness which sees these in the light of the Dhamma, seeing the object which you're contemplating, whether it's the five khandhas, whether it's the six sense bases, in whatever form, even if it's in the form of the jhana experience you've just had, and in the back of it, not in the back, sorry, in the front of your mind is anicca, dukkha, anatta, and their mindfulness is powerful enough to gain enlightenment. Less than that is not. Less than that, you're still building. You're still doing the preliminary exercises. Those preliminary exercises are important, but this is where they're leading to. So that's how I understand sati, this place in the Eightfold Path, and how, if developed to this degree, will lead to the freeing of the mind from the defilements, the liberating of the mind from delusion, and having a mind which knows it's liberated, knows that birth is destroyed, there is no more being. Has anyone got any comments or questions about the talk this evening on sati? You're asking that using anicca with the breath, is that a useful thing to do? Right. Yes, it is useful. I was going to answer that first of all. The first thought which came into my mind was it's always useful. And I'm not going to say that. And for this reason, I'm glad you asked this question, because there is a time when it is not useful to look upon the experience in terms of anicca, dukkha, anatta. At the beginning of the meditation, the middle of the meditation, when the mind is getting concentrated, it always does help to remember anicca, dukkha, anatta, because it frees the mind of the hindrances. However, that if it is a time to enter a jhana, the hindrances are overcome, or wishes to enter into a jhana, that is not the time to bring up the sati of anicca, dukkha, anatta. If you do that, then the mind will turn away from the samadhi nimitta. I think this is especially like the dukkha sanya. This is especially the one which I'm talking about. The anatta sanya, that will not obstruct the mind entering into a jhana. Because the anatta sanya just lets go of control. However, the dukkha sanya always will tend to almost like repel the mind. And the anicca sanya will stop the ability of samadhi to maintain itself on one object. Because you recall change, you're encouraging change, you're looking for change, and change usually occurs. So I would not recommend at the time when one is just about to enter jhana to bring up the idea of anicca or dukkha. I think this is a time just to look for the sukha of the experience. And I say to look for the sukha because this is all in the realm of sanya, of perception. Whether it's anicca, dukkha or anicca, dukkha, anatta, these are perceptions, sanyas, ways of looking at the experience. At the time of entering jhana, one looks at the experience in terms of sukha. One actually turns the perception in that direction to look for the beautiful aspect of that experience. If one doesn't look for it, very often one doesn't see it. Many monks get to a peaceful state, but they don't turn their sanya towards the joy and happiness in that state. Because they don't turn their perception to that, they don't see it, and there's not the cause for the mind to become absorbed. The mind only becomes absorbed in that which it likes, that which it finds pleasant. And I think I've said this before in the development of jhanas, that when the hindrances are gone, one even develops even a sukha sanya. They develop the perception of happiness. As it says in the Anapanasati Sutta, I will breathe in and breathe out, developing sukha, developing piti as well. One does this deliberately, turning the perception onto sukha sanya. And so that's why this is the one time which I think that it's not wise to develop the anicca, so the dukkha sanya, if one is just about to enter into a jhana. Maybe if one is skilled in jhanas, it won't be an obstacle. But at this particular stage, I think it will be. And also the anicca sanya as well. Because here one is not looking for those things which are changing. One is looking for a samadhi state. And again, samadhi has one of the attributes of a state which lasts a long time, like sustaining, maintaining. And so at this particular stage, I think one should not arouse anicca sanya, because that might see in that experience those things which are changing and will hinder one from getting into a jhana. Does that make sense to you?
What I was actually looking for was that with feedback, like developing that perception, whether that would assist by letting go, in the letting go process, and moving towards access.
Yes, you're asking whether there's the development of the mindfulness which we call anicca, dukkha, anatta will actually help in the letting go process. And again, it does help in the letting go process. And my point was that sometimes it will help in the letting go of the samadhi nimitta. And to get into a jhana, one lets go of the opposites and still holds on to one thing.
It's not useful. like in the beginning and then the practitioner drops it when they're getting close.
Yeah, it is very useful in the beginning, because in the beginning that the mind is mostly aware of the obstacles to jhanas, the obstacles to samadhi, and the hindrances is what usually are the objects of the mind, or the objects of the mind are just affected by those hindrances. And if one can let go of those through the development of the recollection of anicca, dukkha, anatta, it helps enormously. But again, I'm just making a point. One always makes a point and stresses just like exceptions. Just, I think, from my experience, this is not from the suttas. I haven't read this anywhere in the suttas. This is like experiential teaching. The only time when I would not advise recollecting anicca, dukkha, anatta is when one is about to enter into jhana. All other occasions, yes. And again, my reason is because if one is unskilled, one will very often apply those three characteristics to the samadhi nimitta, which is arising, and it will destroy that samadhi nimitta. It is true that the samadhi nimitta is anicca, dukkha, anatta, but one is not putting the attention on that aspect of it for the sake of concentrating the mind and empowering the mind so that one can develop the great insights into anicca, dukkha, anatta afterwards. One is, if it were just putting them aside for a moment. Are you going to ask a question?
It's like the letting go, even when the mind comes together, but there's also the aspect of attaching, and sometimes it's a bit difficult to know what one is actually letting go and what one is actually attaching to.
Yes, you're asking about the practice of meditation, is a letting go and attaching. And I think the best explanation of that is that the path towards enlightenment and even the path into jhanas is a gradual path. And one has to know the order in which things are let go. And years ago, I think, I gave a simile of like climbing a ladder. And to climb a ladder, you have to put your hand on the rung above you and grip it, grasp it, and let go of the rung underneath you to pull yourself up. And once you're up on top of that rung you were grasping onto, then you grasp the one above it and let go of that one. And the gradual training is, especially in jhanas, is just that. If you notice the Anapanasati Sutta, the first thing you have to grasp is just to know the breath as it goes in, as it goes out, each breath one after the other, to make sure you have that firmly in mind first of all, and you let go of that so you can develop the full awareness of the breath, all the way in, all the way out, continuous awareness. And then you have to hold on to that. And remember the simile which I gave of the child's small toy car, which you have to push it across on the floor again and again and again. These are those toy cars with little gears inside of them, until it builds up enough momentum. You can't let it go yet. Keep pushing it again and again, running it forwards and forwards and forwards and forwards until it builds up enough speed. Then you let it go. And in the stage where one is still developing just the complete awareness, full awareness of the whole body of breath, you have to attach to that, not let it go yet. And then you develop the piti sukha by developing the perception that this is a... Oh, sorry, you calm the breath next and then you develop the perception of the piti sukha, of the joy in this peaceful breath, this beautiful breath. And you have to let go of the coarse breath, and you look and attach to that beautiful breath. And then that beautiful breath turns into a jhana, and you let go of that coarse nimitta or mind state to enter into a jhana. And as you go into the jhanas, you let go of the lower jhanas to get into the higher jhanas. So, and each time you're actually letting go of more. But to be able to let go completely, and the only way you really let go completely, full letting go, is letting go of body, speech and mind. Letting go of all of the sankharas, which is nirodha, samapatti. When we talk about letting go, the full letting go is cessation. You're actually not just letting go of some external objects like thought, you're letting go of feeling and perception, letting go of consciousness. That's true letting go. But to only let go of consciousness, it has to be done gradually. You can't jump right up from the bottom to the top of the ladder. Even the Buddha didn't do that, always went through the jhanas to gain cessation. So you do attach to one thing, and let go of what's below, what's coarse, and then resting on that thing you've been attaching to grasp higher. That's how it appears, and that's a valid way of using the mind. Does that answer the question? What was that? Again, it's one of the problems that of not understanding letting go, that people let go of that thing which they should be attaching to, and they attach to that which they should let go of. Very often for ordinary people, many people, they let go of sila first of all before they gain any sort of wisdom at all. And they fall off the ladder. Is there any other question or comment on the talk this evening? Okay.